Good afternoon. We'll continue on with our next case, Michael Gibbons with Judge Jerome Tao and Judge Abby Silver. Excuse me. We have case number 66090, Moraga v. Employers Insurance Company of Nevada. This is the time set for the argument. And is it Mr. Woodrum?
Yes, Mr. Moraga.
All right. And Mr. Smith?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm in Division of Industrial Relations.
And who's with you?
John Lee-Rubeck.
Oh, so that is with you. All right. Are you both going to argue, or?
Probably, Your Honor. If we could split our time into 15 minutes, I'll take 8 of it, and John will take the next 7.
All right. Thank you. With this one, you sit down, Mr. Smith, then Mr. Waver can have at it. Mr. Woodrum, are you ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'll be looking on behalf of Mr. Moraga, appellant in this matter. Please, the court, judges, thank you for having us here today. I know you sort of get stuck with these as a part of the appellant program.
Thank you for taking the case.
Thank you for taking the case, as always. This is an interesting case. It's also, I think, a very limited case in scope. It's interesting because just the sheer scope of the amount of time that's been involved since the 1989 industrial accident that Mr. Moraga was involved in. Everybody's always agreed that it was an industrial accident. He was originally given a surgery. It's all very much in the past. He apparently re-injures me, and again, I'm not entirely sure why. I think actually, the vision's brief addresses it better than I was able to. His injury was aggravated while he was in prison in 2001, resulting in a stipulation to reopen the injury room. And I guess there was some play about that. There was an appeal to the appellate office. That was ultimately in 2003 stipulation, which is really what brings us here today, not to belabor the point. The 2003 stipulation had two what I call substantive provisions. One is that the claim would be reopened for a partial permanent disability evaluation. And the part two was that the insurer should have no responsibility to transport Mr. Moraga from prison to his appointments. I have absolutely always understood that and always conceded that. And I think everybody in this case has always done the same. The issue is that there has been, since the beginning of this 2003 stipulation, there has been this conflating of the ideas that not needing to provide transportation equates or is equal to being allowed to interfere with transportation. And that, I think, is at the heart of this. So,
what is the affirmative act, though? What is the affirmative act that EICN did to cause him not to be transported?
Well, it's interesting. I just sort of created my own record on that.
He created his own one?
Yeah, insurance.
Oh, okay.
The insurance adjuster at the McFeer sent a letter to Mr. Moraga. He was in prison at the time. He knew it. They addressed it to him there in prison. They said, we have scheduled your appointments. In accordance with the stipulation, we scheduled your appointments. But that, because of prison security protocols,
we didn't mention this, and I understand that you took this to the program, you didn't handle this down below, so you might not know the answer. Why didn't somebody try to find out why he wasn't transported? Presumably there's some prison official who knows why he wasn't transported to the two appointments, but I didn't see that anywhere in the record. Somebody tried to take a deposition. I know you're probably the one down there who doesn't know that. You showed up the first reason, but do you know, or have you investigated that?
I'm glad I'm not as disadvantaged because the division did not bring me a division of attorney either, but I don't know that. I didn't live with this case. And that's a very good question. I would have liked to see some investigation on that point, but the reason I say now, this is a substantial evidence question. This is a substantial. Those are substantial.
And I know I'm going outside the record, but just as a matter of curiosity, I'm just trying to get to the bottom of what happened here. But as I said, you probably wouldn't know
that. My honest and candid answer would be that it seems the Nevada Attorney for Injured Workers sort of dropped the ball on Mr. Moraga. And they were involved, and then they went, and then that persisted for some time.
I want to go back, though, to have my question answered, which is, what affirmative act did EICN do? Affirmative act to prevent the transporting of Morgana from the prison to to the doctors.
Yes, there's an affidavit. I'm looking at myself.
That's what I want to see. Where in the record is there affidavit that you do something besides went down the same meeting you screwed up my transport?
It's at the appendix when I bought.
Okay.
And so it's, and I remember my appendix kind of strangely because there was always so much numbering on it, but it's MOR when I bought. And the affidavit act on the writing is that they sent a letter to Mr. Moraga after saying that they couldn't do that. They sent him a letter with his date on it, with his appointment date on it. They sent him a letter in October, August. They sent him a letter and said, we scheduled your appointments, we can't tell you when you're off. They sent him a letter in October that said, by the way, here's when your appointments are. Make sure you wear your shorts and bring your driver's license.
Why did they say we can't tell you when you are? I mean, you know, in criminal court, we spout off the next court date on a constant, and district court is there. We'll see you on your next court date on February 3rd. They're a criminal. They're looking at a murder case. They know exactly when the court dates are. You can bet they do.
Well, and again,
and Nevada Department of Prisons is sitting right there, and they write it down. Defendant knows, PD knows, everybody knows. So I didn't understand even in the record what, for what security murder someone was going to be transported.
That's your judgment. I don't want to stray too far outside the record of the scope of this appeal, but I guess the short answer would be that there's some, and you know, fairly well. There's a difference between what the jails do and how they operate, and what the prisons do and how they operate. And you're right that the jail inmates always know because they're in court. What are you going to do about it? But the thing with jail inmates is they take them down, they walk them under the building, they bring them up and out of it.
Oh, no, no. I'm talking about NSP.
And
we have plenty of people that are awaiting trial, they're in on a murder, they've got another murder case going, maybe another rape, who knows. And they're sitting there under a sentence of imprisonment, and they certainly know their court dates. We get them out in court. It's not like a big secret. Ooh, you can't tell them because they might escape. Yeah. Everybody knows in the courtroom.
I think they
just went on to the computer.
I think there may just be some due process issues involved with knowing one's progression of one's criminal case, but don't attach to somebody who's going to block you to the evaluation.
We're all a little bit outside the record, but just speaking of experience, you know, we announce court dates, but sometimes the prison doesn't ring because there's a lockdown, there's some security incident. How do you know something like that didn't happen here? And that wasn't the reason that he wasn't transported. I know we're outside the record, and that goes to the question I asked, which is, did anybody look into this? But I didn't see it anywhere. But I know you, the point I'm making is you're trying to blame this on this letter, right?
Of course.
And that's a plausible argument, I understand it, but how did anybody there say, was there a lockdown, was there a riot? I mean, you know, it's a prison, stuff like that happens, and they lock it all down, no one gets transported.
I understand.
Having difficulties in solitary, that kind of thing.
Judges, I'm with you 100%, both of you. There are facts which are absent, which I wish were present in the record, but there are steps that were not taken at the district court and appellate level that I wish had been taken. Again, I can't fix those things.
With the Supreme Court, when dealing with prisoners, it sometimes come up with bright line rules, like they've added 3 days to file an appeal. It used to be 30, then it's 33, or there are certain mailbox rules that are different from other litigation. Is there some systemic problem here where there needs to be a bright line rule, or is there something unique about this case? And if there is, isn't it the responsibility of the appellant to show us where it is in the record?
Well, sure. I mean, I guess, again, this is, I guess the question is there an affirmative act which interferes with an appointment which was scheduled?
Mm-hmm.
And the evidence I have to point to is that the insurance company took upon itself to do something which they knew they were not supposed to do. And again, I don't know any bigger questions about MBS's policies and what was going on that day. And frankly, this far in the past, I don't think we could ever really get into it. Who knows what was happening that particular day?
Well, attorney, it isn't the record that his attorney tried to reschedule the appointments. What happened?
Well, I don't know. And frankly, it puzzled me throughout the preparation of this appeal and preparation of the argument, which is why somebody in 2003, 2004 didn't just reschedule his evaluation. It would have been one more day and it would have been over. But instead, it's been this continual quest to avoid doing that. And I don't understand why. And I don't think it's a systemic problem with people serving life sentences who also happen to have open workers' comp claims. I don't have a feeling that there's a whole lot of those, especially a whole lot that are this remote in time. With an inmate who I mean, I can assume is first inmates are doing, has an interest, a fiduciary interest in pursuing appeals they can pursue and wrongs that they think they can right. But what I do then is that there was an affirmative act. And if the president, if the insurer had not sent that letter and they said no briefing, I don't think we would be here. And this would not be an issue if they hadn't sent that letter. It is not enough, and then to avoid it continually for 6 years and then continuing on with this petition for judicial appeal agreement. I think that, and kudos to the divisions on drafting the treaty, did a fine job. But even in their brief, they can conflate these issues. And they bolded. Insurer was not responsible for claims transportation or for his failure to attend. I get that. I get that that's in the stipulation. I get that they have no responsibility to transport or insure transport. But I will continue to assert that I have a responsibility not to send that letter that they knew. Like I said at the beginning, they made no record. They said, here's something we can't do, and you are doing it. I don't know what else to say. I mean, but that, don't send a letter you're not supposed to send. And who says this is over? I don't know if that was intentional. I doubt it. It wouldn't make very much sense.
So you're saying that they should just send it to the attorney and that's it?
Absolutely. And I think Mr. Watson, who's the Nevada attorney for injured workers, said, I've scheduled these before and had absolutely no problems. Mm-hmm. So you're right. You know, maybe they should have.
What if they really did do something wrong? What about the timeliness of how this proceeded from that point? Isn't it really untimely?
Well, no, I certainly wouldn't be here if I thought that that was untimely. I would have probably just declined this at least argument, if not briefing. I think that the elephant in the room that my group answering didn't address at all is in Ray Davis, which says that there are circumstances where there is not an express statute of limitations, and I believe that statute of limitations is a creature of statute, but there's not an express statute of limitations that latches is sufficient to protect people from remote acts. And that's the thing. Clearly, and if you look at the interplay and how sort of industrial insurance law has developed from Fallon to Madera, clearly, the legislature took some very affirmative acts to make workers' comp statutes so ugly, and they did not see fit to include any statute of limitations for these harms. 11.190 applies to causes of action, and the cause of action is a civil action. I mean, I'm accused of trying to rewrite the statute. I don't think I'm even trying to do that. I think that there is no statute of limitations that applies, and that latches would be sufficient. Now, if you want to go argue latches, well, it's been 6 years, well, fantastic, we'll argue that. Let the judge make that factual finding. But that factual finding was not made here. It was always just, well, 11.190 cuts us off in 2 years. To me, for a case that obviously, and by stipulation, was pending from 89 until 2003, it seems a little strange to take a case that could come for life and apply a statute of limitations to it that cuts you off in 2 years. You don't need that ceremony in 2 years if the violation had occurred.
So your contention there is that it's not the 2-year statute of limitations under 11.1904B. So what statute of limitations would apply? I thought I heard you just say that no statute applies to this.
And if you look at N. Ray Davis, the circumstances are slightly different, but if you look at N. Ray Davis, you'll see that latches was thought to be sufficient. Just a principle that you cannot do something that's 15 years old, but maybe you can do something that's 6.
That's factual. This is really to give a penalty against an agency.
Sure.
So it's like an limitless.
I think that latches equals limitlessness. I think latches is a factual finding, which it could very well have been made in this case.
Right? Well, I mean, the problem with the latches argument is, in theory, latches can accrue before the statute of limitations has expired.
Again, factual finding. Let the judge or let the appellate officer make that factual finding.
We have about 2 minutes. All right. Mr. Slick, have you broken this up into subject areas between you,
I have the opening. I'm going to try to address some of your questions. I'm going to sit down and give Mr. Lakeman an opportunity to deal with substantial evidence and whether or not it's supported in the record, and then I'm going to come back and do the statute.
Well, let me ask the obvious question here. Why was this letter sent if everybody knows this letter shouldn't have been sent? Do you know? I mean, maybe that's out of the record now, but do you know what letter
should there's a very simple, straightforward, point blank answer, which is NAC 616C103 sub 3 sub B specifically requires.
Can you say that statute one more time? I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's a regulation. NAC 616C103 parent 3 parent sub B small b. The insurer shall comply in setting forth and doing the PPD. And sub B explicitly states mailing written notice to the injured employee of the date, time, and place of the appointment for the rating evaluation. End quote. Arguably, had they not done that, my client, the Division of Industrial Relations, would be rather distressed or upset. Please note that when you review the stipulation itself, and we're talking about the stipulation in 723.03, and I can give you the page in the numbers, I hope.
Well, here's the second question.
Yes,
your contention is that it should be sent. Why wasn't a second letter sent with the second appointment? Why was only one letter sent when there were two appointments?
You know, I can't answer that question. Number one, I was not the attorney of record in the first matter. Number two, I'm looking at the record as it exists today. Number three, that's one of the questions I have in reviewing this matter. And it's the same thing that I was going to point out to you, which is there is very little of the records, policies and procedures from the Department of Prison in this matter, anywhere in the record. Number one. Number two, there is very little in terms of what the communication the matter attorney for injured workers had with the Department of Prisons. We were obviously not copying on any of that.
Well, so let me ask you this. This is what it seems like it boils down to. His argument here is that you guys should interfere with this appointment by sending this letter. You're saying this letter should have, not you, but him. He's saying you should have sent this letter. You're saying that letter should have been sent.
Absolutely.
But it wasn't sent as to the second appointment. So the question is, okay, it seems like everyone's agreeing that EIC at some level screwed up. Either the letter should have been sent, or two letters, either no letter should have been sent, which is what you say, or two letters should have been sent. So if there is a screw up somewhere, whether it's, you know, zero letters or two letters, his argument is, okay, sending the first letter interfered with your appointment. You're saying the opposite, that you didn't really form the appointment, but you didn't form the second appointment, so why isn't that a screw up?
No, I'm not wrong. And let me explain the difference for you. It happens quite regularly in workers' compensation cases that you will have an initial permanent partial disability evaluation, which has to be scheduled by the insurer pursuant to the statutes and regulations, and that's 103.3B. It is not unusual at all to have a second PPD or another appointment that is scheduled by claimant's counsel. Claimant's counsel, and the identity in this case, does not have that same affirmative obligation because they're scheduling that on behalf of their client. And there is no liability or requirement for them to report it back to the insurer.
Why wasn't there, it appears that you tried to reschedule the appointment, and then what happened? It's unclear after the November 26, 2003 letter, requesting that EIC reschedule its medical appointment due to the failure to transport. And then it's like, what happened?
I agree with you. I have no idea what happened. And the first thing I'm going to do is to know what happened. All I can say is I assume somebody tried to reschedule. I'm not aware of it. The division is not aware of anything because the division had a very limited duty and responsibility. If I can back up, if I answer any more questions. I know, it never turns out that
we want to be one of the easy on Mr. Langer, so we're going to get him.
Okay. Is that it?
No, we're just warming up for Langer. He can do it.
Oh, yeah, you can take it. You can, Your Honor. I agree with you. Workers' comp is a highly regulated area. It's all by statute. It's all by regulation. It's a creature of statute. It was created by statute. It never existed in the common law. And that's what we're looking at. And when we talk about these things, everything is highly regulated. You know, a PPD has to be scheduled within 30 days under NRS 616C490. The evaluation, the PPD rating physician has to be selected by a list from the Division of Industrial Relations. A specific guide is mandated by statute, that's 616C110. I've already gone over 616C103, NAC 616C103B3, and the requirement for the letter. You know, all these things are very regulated by statute. It's a creature of statute. It exists solely by statute. There are time limits throughout on many benefits of what can occur or not occur. That being said, I will sit down and let you know.
All right.
That's it. Make one correction for him, though, that I told him I would, which is in details and synopsis, it talks as if Mr. Mulrady was denied medical treatment. That is not accurate. What he was denied was a PPD evaluation, which is not treatment. It's for figuring out a level of compensation for the permanent partial disability.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
John, on behalf of the Employers Insurance Company of Nevada. In response to Judge Towne's question of, okay, you sent the first letter, why wouldn't you send the second letter? There has to be, by definition, a screw-up one way or another. If by sending the first letter, that created the problem that prevented him from being sent out because it was some security risk?
Well, that's his argument.
So I understand that. So carrying that argument to its logical conclusion, if the first letter is what caused the problem in the first place, why in God's green earth would you send the second letter knowing that it's going to create the exact same problem, just going to keep going in a circle? Because every time he has an evaluation, the regulation says you have to notify him. We notified him. The Department of Prison said we're not going to transfer him for whatever reason. We don't know what that reason was. But if we didn't turn around and send a second letter, we're just going to be standing there turning in circles.
The reason I ask the question is because he seemed to be saying you're required by regulation to send a letter, and that's why the first letter was even sent.
Well, then
what you're saying now is after you send the first letter, you then consciously violated the regulation with the second letter.
No, I think it became a matter of addressing with the Nevada Attorney for the Workers that this guy needs to be scheduled for an evaluation, and it's outside of our control. The Department of Prisons is interfering in this in some fashion by not allowing it. We don't have any control. My client is the Employers Insurance Company that has absolutely no control over the Department of Prisons, nor is the Division of Industrial Regulation. We can tell them to agree in the face. I think you're all perfectly well aware of that. They're going to do what they normally want the way they want. The explanation for that is unknown. But again, to carry the logic of continuing to send a letter that's, at least in theory, and I won't concede the issue one way or another, but in theory is the source of a problem, it would be foolish, quite frankly, to continue to send that same letter and have the same result. It's Einstein's definition of insanity. So to that end, it makes no sense. With respect to the statute, I guess you guys had your chance with Mr. Smith, so I don't want to take a bunch of time going back over the same things.
But he did say, they sent the letter the first time. After that, maybe it was Nevada, or the attorney for Nevada injured a worker who said he was sending a follow-up letter. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. It's very accurate. And in fact, the stipulation on its face makes reference to the fact that the Nevada Attorney for New Work is just going to make the arrangements for this to occur. And so that statement is absolutely 100% correct.
So if there's nothing else in the record, it's safe to assume that his own attorney dropped the ball in transportation?
Yeah.
And next thing you know, we have 5,000 appeals? Is that what happened?
I'm not going to throw Mr. Watson under the bus because I don't know what he did or did not do. I know that at the end of the day, we are charged with the responsibility by virtue of the stipulation to schedule this guy for his interdisciplinary evaluation, which we did. He didn't get transported. And I guess that's that begs, again, the inherent question that people that didn't get scheduled the first time and
And supposedly the employer's insurance company, Nevada, intentionally interfered with that, and I take great exception with that characterization. But nonetheless, so be it. Okay, the evaluation did not take place. That does not mean that it could not, should not, would not have been rescheduled had that set of circumstances presented itself. I don't know why it didn't occur again. I don't know why it didn't occur in the first place, other than the division. The Department of Prisons said, he's not going. I have no control over that. I don't even know that the Department of Prisons didn't send him because of this letter. I just know that the Department of Prisons said, he's not going. I have no control over that. Mr. Watson, in defense of Mr. Watson, has no power over that. All he can do is ask. All I can do is ask. The DIR comes in and reviews my conduct in light, and I say my conduct, I mean the conduct of the division of the employer's insurance company in Nevada. He comes in and says, look, there's a stipulation. You guys are supposed to set this guy up for his injury disability evaluation. Did you do that? Well, clearly we did that. Because we've got a letter that says here he's supposed to do it. The division, the Department of Business didn't send him. So be it. Did I interfere with the ability to do that? That's the assertion. I think Judge Silverman, the comments are well on point with respect to that. And again, we don't even know that that's why the Department of Prisons did or did not do what they did. But at the end of the day, the Division of Industrial Regulation is charged with determining under 616D120. They're charged with coming in and reviewing my conduct, and again, when I say my conduct, I mean the conduct of the employer's insurance company in Nevada, to see if we complied with the stipulation. I don't think there could be any dispute that we did. Did it come to fruition? No. Do we know not why? No. The other statement that was made that I thought was at least interesting is the court, you all said it's just the Court of Appeals, we need errors of law, not questions of fact. So when we look back to the Latches question, well, this is a factual question. It's a factual question. Well, it's not an error of law.
He says there is no statute of limitations because, you know, we know how old this is.
It's
really old.
This is patently incorrect. I mean, that's what 11.190 sub 46 says. Sub B, I'm sorry. Says. I mean, this is a civil matter. This is a civil penalty, because that's what he's asking for, is a benefit penalty. By its name, by its very nature, by it's a statutory creation. Mr. Smith is that absolutely correct. It is a civil penalty, because these are parallel proceedings. I guess I need to make sure that we're clear with that. You have the underlying industrial insurance claim that runs to its fruition at the end of an industrial insurance claim. You have a residual disability evaluation. People show the likelihood of a permanent impairment, which is really led by this stipulation. The proceeding asking for a benefit penalty is a parallel proceeding. It is not tied directly to the provision of medical care or the administration of workers' compensation benefits directly to the claimant, directly to an injured worker. The benefit penalty proceeding does is the DIR comes in and says, did you follow the rules? Did you do what you were supposed to do as an insurance company, as an insurance administrator? Did you comply with what you're supposed to comply with by statute? And again, under 11.190, it's clear, and it can't be any clearer, that if it is not specifically addressed in the statute otherwise, and it's not anywhere, trust me, there's plenty of time limits governed by Chapter 616 and 617 of the revised statute. But it specifically says that it's not provided for otherwise in the statute, and it's not. I don't think there's any dispute about that. Look at 2 years. 2 years, maps. I mean, you can map on this anywhere you want. You can start just about at any point where you can find something happened and when it didn't happen. And they're not going to follow it in 2 years. And if you don't follow it in 2 years, you're out of my jurisdiction. And just as a final word, issues of jurisdiction are mandatory and non-discretionary. It's SIRS versus Partner Roche.
Why did the district court take so long to decide the petition? It's like 4 years. I wanted to know if you know at all why it took 4 years for the district court to decide a petition for judicial review.
If you want my honest opinion why I think it took that long, it's a work on matter that nobody wants to touch because they don't like doing work on matters to begin with. And you've got an inmate in Nevada State Prison who's there for life. So what's the urgency? So I think when it came to the priority of looking at this and looking at what was going on, it's the only explanation I can give you.
That's not exactly a very lengthy order either.
No, and again, for me to sit
and
listen to a much better idea, quite candidly, is why...
That's what I don't understand. Yeah. I mean, was it continued 5,000 times? What will it take 4 years to take a petition and go through
the
right,
that's,
right.
That's the thing. The reason I think what Judge Silver's asking is because we want to do this. I've never taken 4 years, so you have no idea.
I have my better idea. 4 years to go through district court.
Absolutely. I can tell you that this is the area in which I practice. I have other cases that tend to sit, workers' compensation cases, and I'm not about to sit here and throw any district court judge into the...
Don't you try to get it in calendar, or no, you...
I was filing orders to shorten time to get through this meeting, and I have appeared in front of you for years. I think you have some idea of how I approach this process, and as with Judge Town. I cannot speak to the motivations or lack of motivations for...
Was it continued a bunch of times?
No, it's not, because there's no need to. It's a fairly straightforward issue, so that it's not as though, and again, because it's a record on appeal, it's an appellate issue, you're not working on other people's schedules. It's briefing on fairly straightforward, two fairly straightforward issues, and putting it in front of the court to give you a decision. There's not a whole lot, and there wasn't a whole lot of argument. We probably did more argument today than we did during the course of the entire appellate process. I can't speak to with any degree of...
Did they transport him?
And I think there was, at one point, there was some suggestion that may occur, but if you don't have, I say a lot of time, so that's
a question
for me.
All right. All right, Mr. Woodrum, you have 2 more minutes.
Thank you, Ron.
At the risk of cutting into my time too much, I'll say, even from my law court days, if these aren't brought to the court's attention, sometimes they will just languish. There are 2 points I wish to address. I don't like to chase my tail in rebuttal, but there are 2 points that were addressed that were raised today by opposing counsel. One is AOC 616C, which is, I quickly checked the briefs, and I don't want to talk out of turn, but that's the first reference to that NAC I've heard. So I'm sure your law clerks will tell you whether or not my assertion bears out or not. The other issue...
Do you want a chance to respond?
I'm sorry?
Do you want any other chance to respond to that?
You want more briefings or...
Not really.
You know, we'll look at it.
I think that was in response to one of our questions.
Oh, sure. I'm just saying of the process, which tends to be fairly strict in the appellate courts, which is this opening brief, answering brief. I don't think it needs an answering brief, and I ask you not to consider that. The other issue is Emily Davis, and maybe I'm hanging my head on the wrong peg here, but I'll tell you, neither answering brief addressed that. It has been more of the same, which is... and again, not to cast aspersions, both counsel were completely fair today in the argument. It is an issue which is again just been handled, which is, well, there's not law 190. Well, obviously it applies. Well, tell me why, you know? And when I was briefing this, I tried to find out why. And I tried to find out if there was any legislative history that would shine light on that. And I tried to find out if there was any case law that would shine light on that, and unfortunately there's not. But there is case law that sheds light on Latches. I'm not asking this court to apply or not apply Latches, which would be a factual determination. The issue of law I'm asking this court to apply is that the issue of Latches does apply, and that it is a factual determination that somebody should make, be it the appellate office or obviously Judge Baer when it gets to his court eventually.
I mean, this is actually it ties to the question, I'll a couple minutes you have to answer the very last question I actually read at the tail end of the argument, which was, you know, launches can kick in before a statute of limitations applies. My point is, launches and statute of limitations aren't mutually exclusive. You can have both. There are cases out there that say in certain extreme situations, you haven't even reached a statute of limitations, but so much has happened, so there's a prejudice, that launches kicks in anyway. So you can have both. It's not an either-or situation, but it sounds like you're saying it is an either or. If Davis, you know, if the latches principle that Davis applies here, well, you're kind of saying, well, that's in lieu of statute of limitations. Why isn't it both?
Well, it's not the first question. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer to that. I guess my thought would be when we're talking about latches, you'd be talking about a situation where there might be longer than 2 years statute of limitations. And I think that that's just sort of a judgment call. Maybe you're not going to get to latches when you've got a 2 year statute of limitations. I think of latches...
Yeah, it's probably less likely because it's a shorter one. Sure. But there are cases with longer ones, and it's like 10 years statute of limitations, but a lot has happened in the 10 years.
Sure, and I think about even like the successive habeas petition, which may be permissible for some reason, if it's 15 years late. That's kind of the latches that's going to kick in there, even though the statute of limitations is 1 year. I can't, just off the top of my head, think of a situation where you kick in latches prior to expiration of 2 year statute of limitations while litigation was pending. My time is well over, and again, I appreciate the time, and I would ask you to remain
and thank you for taking the podium.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Woodrum. Excellent job by all our counsel. Mr. Woodrum, great to have you again. Yes, now we'll stand submitted for a decision from the